The things I have to say this morning sometimes may be taken a little hesitantly about Luther's success in Melanchthon. I mean all in good faith. Of all the possibilities that presented themselves to Archbishop Thomas Cranmer on the accession of Edward VI, the one that seems to have most basis to his purpose of advancing English Protestantism was the convening at Lambeth Palace of a Protestant council composed of leading continental reformers. Not only would such a council contribute to the establishing of one sound, pure evangelical doctrine agreeable to the discipline of the primitive church, but it would also provide Cranmer an opportunity for conferring directly with major continental reformers on theological questions about which he had not yet made a final decision. Although Cranmer had been at work for some time on the English prayer book, he had not yet solidified his opinions on principal problems such as the nature of the Eucharist, the ordination of priests, nor even the matter of ecclesiastical polity. During 1547, numerous continental Protestants gathered around Cranmer at Lambeth to aid him in making such decisions. Peter Alexander, who had been chaplain to Queen Mary of Hungary, Bernardino Ottino, who had been for a time the Italian minister at Geneva, and Peter Martyr, who had been professor of theology at Strasbourg, all joined Cranmer at Lambeth in the first year of Edward's reign. But these men did not have the relatively long Protestant tradition behind them that the leaders at Wittenberg, Strasbourg, Zurich, and Geneva could boast. Cranmer was particularly anxious, therefore, to obtain aid from these Protestant centers. He wrote repeatedly to Philip Melanchthon, Luther's successor at Wittenberg, and to Martin Luther, minister at Strasbourg, to encourage them to come to England. Not until later in Edward's reign did he seek out Henry Bullinger, who had taken the leadership at Zurich on the death of Zwingli. Nor did Calvin and Geneva receive an early invitation from Cranmer, perhaps this has been suggested because of the strained Anglo-French situation at the beginning of Edward's reign. Three of these men, however, in their letters to Cranmer, displayed a deep concern for the advancement of the English Church. As early as March 26, 1539, Melanchthon had written Cranmer from Wittenberg that there was a need for a consensus pied doctrina. Bucer wrote Cranmer a long letter in which he repeatedly praised the idea of church councils and stated that there are many common wills and countries whom, if we were duly to call them together, we should be able without any difficulty to draw over into an alliance with Christ. From Geneva, Calvin wrote, as far as I am concerned, if it appears that I can be of any service, I shall not shrink from crossing 10 seas if need be. There is no comparable letter from Bullinger. His English correspondence did not reach sizable proportions until John Cooper, who had been at Zurich with Bullinger from 1547 to 1549, returned to England in March of 1549. By the end of that year, however, the English relationship with Zurich was growing more cordial. On October 20th, Edward wrote the Senate to Zurich, there is also an equal agreement between us concerning the Christian relation and true godliness, which ought to render this friendship of ours by God's blessing yet more intimate. This protestation of friendship and the assurance of support from continental reformers do not always agree with these men's actual attitude toward England. A study of the men who came to England from these four centers indicates a great deal more about the continental leaders' relationship with England than do these formal statements that I have just read you. Only one man of importance came to England from Geneva in the first years of Edward's reign. Anthony Rodolphe Chevalier, who had taught the English nobleman Thomas Bidley Hebrew when he was in Geneva as a boy, came to England in 1548. He lived with Cranmer for about a year before taking up residence with the Italian immigrant Emmanuel Cornelius, who was then Hebrew professor at Cambridge. During his year with Cranmer, he was frequently consulted on matters of Old Testament interpretation, and at Cambridge he gave free Hebrew lectures. As a reward for his services at Lambeth and Cambridge, he was promised in 1552 the next canonry or prebend to fall vacant in Canterbury Cathedral. In addition to his activities at Lambeth and Cambridge, he was also French tutor to the Princess Elizabeth. The holding of this position is in itself an indication of the respect which Cranmer and Protector Somerset must have had for Chevalier's religious opinion. A person whose orthodoxy was suspect would not have been allowed so close a contact with the possible future sovereign. Chevalier's activities in the English church, university, and court are visible evidence that one Genevan is trying to see that the doctrine of God may be preached with strength and virtue for to bring forth fruit, as Calvin had suggested in a letter to Professor Somerset. The representatives who arrived from Wittenberg during the first years of Edward's reign, on the other hand, were of an entirely different sort. Cranmer, knowing Melanchthon's interest in a united like the Protestant Church, wrote, "I'm aware that you have often desired that wise and godly men should take counsel together. We therefore request you to communicate your counsel and opinion to us in person." Instead of coming to England himself, however, Melanchthon sent over the younger Justice Jonas and Francis Dryander. Jonas, whose father's Lutheran catechism Cranmer had just finished having translated, had himself never made any contribution to the Reformation. In 1546, when Halle was captured by the emperor and barred to Saxony, whom the elder Jonas had attacked, the family was forced to flee. Melanchthon, capitalizing on the family's name, seems to have sent Jonas to England more for the boy's own safety than for any aid Jonas might offer in advancing the Reformation in England. The second man to come to Melanchthon was only a few years older than Jonas, but a far more experienced Protestant. Francis Ancinus, or Dryander as he is sometimes called, born about 1520 of a noble Spanish family, went to Wittenberg to study with Melanchthon when he was not yet 20. After a visit to Paris in the Low Countries in 1541, he returned to Wittenberg where he finished the translation of the New Testament, a work that Melanchthon had encouraged him to undertake. This translation, intended for dedication to Charles V, so enraged Charles' confessor Pedro Astoto that Encina was imprisoned for a time. In March of 1545, however, he was back in Wittenberg again. Although Encina spent the year 1546 with Luther in Strasbourg and corresponded frequently with Bullinger, he came to England in 1549 with letters of recommendation, not from Luther or Bullinger, but from his old teacher Melanchthon. While he was in England, Encina tried to persuade others to come over also, but he seems to have regarded England as only a temporary place of refuge, for in December of 1549, he took his manuscripts to the continent for publication, rather than having them published in England as other learned refugees had done. He never returned to England after 1549, and was last heard of when he wrote Melanchthon in 1542 that he hoped the new electoral prince would, quote, "have some plague," unquote. Ancinus's refusal to participate more fully in English affairs seems to reflect Melanchthon's own attitude toward England. Although repeatedly professing an interest in England's spiritual welfare, Melanchthon consistently rejected Cranmer's offers for more active involvement in the English Reformation. The two men whom he sent to Cranmer both seem to have viewed England more as a green thicket for hiding than as a white field for harvesting. At least so John Hooper thought when he wrote Bullinger in 1550 concerning Ancinus's return to the continent. He consults his own interests and cares but little for ours when gain is out of the question. From Strasbourg came two men who were both to devote their full energies for a number of years to the cause of Reformation in England. The first, John Utenhovius, a native of Ghent, had studied at Louvain and Cologne before he came to Strasbourg in 1545. For 2.5 years, he was a member of the French church there, which was then under the pastorship of Valerin Poulain. In the summer of 1548, Utenhovius came to England, where he was far more diplomatic than Ancinus had been. Instead of antagonizing leaders of English faction, he seems to have made an effort to please them. Shortly after John Hooper's return from Zurich, Utenhovius established a friendship with him that resulted in Utenhovius being sent to Zurich, which Utenhovius writes, is celebrated above the rest, both for its reputation and pure doctrine. Here he studied with Bullinger, who wrote in June of 1549 that the nobleman Utenhovius of Ghent has far exceeded your commendation of him, and I thank you that through the instrumentality of yourself and Hooper I have contracted a friendship with a man in every way so worthy. Between them, Hooper and Bullinger managed to convert a promising man from Butcher's conservative Strasbourg training to their own more radical Greenland point of view. The success of that effort is indicated in a letter which Utenhovius wrote to Bullinger in June of 1549. He writes, "Send me whatever you have of Butcher's on the Lord's Supper written by him before he began to dote." This same letter announces that Utenhovius is now ready to return to England. Obviously, the indoctrination process has been completed. On his return to England, he joined Hooper in his insistence on making no compromise with the more moderate reformer, a position Butcher himself would hardly have held. Before his departure from Zurich, Utenhovius had recommended another Strasbourg man to service in England. Late in 1548, he had recommended Valerin Poulain, his former minister at Strasbourg, to Peter Marder, who had just left Lambeth to take a position at Oxford. Although Marder did not obtain a position for Poulain at the university as had been anticipated, Poulain almost immediately received Somerset's patronage, which made it possible for him to acquire the politically significant position of superintendent of the Strangers' Church at Glastonbury. He gave every indication that he was anxious to settle in England and contribute to the advancement of the church there. 6 years after his arrival, he was granted a letter of denunciation and left England only to death at Edmund. Luther himself came to England in April of 1549 along with his friend Paul Fabius. Hooper and others who feared his influence with Cranmer were not happy to see him arrive. One English in England expressed the suspicion of many in England who desired further reform when he wrote Bullinger, "May the Lord preserve our England from both of them." Cranmer found in Luther a man who would encourage him in his moderate position. Luther's temperate point of view in the Wesleyan controversy and Eucharistic debate was agreeable to Cranmer, but the Druid group was too powerful a force to be subdued by moderation. Bullinger sent one man, John Ab Ulmer, who was neither a scholar nor a person significant enough to exert much direct influence. Far more useful for Bullinger's interest in England were the persistent efforts from native converts such as Hooper and John Burgess, an English merchant who spent years from 1543 to 1547 in Europe. Men such as these worked steadily to turn less fully committed men from Luther's somewhat ambiguous central position to the simpler Druid's view of widespread reform. More or less regularly in England during the first years of Edward's reign, the genuine influence of the Druid reformers was penetrating the thinking of those who came originally from Strasbourg and other continental centers. The cause is not far to seek. Although Calvin and Melanchthon both protested their interest in English religion, they failed to send to England a sizable number of useful spokesmen for their position. Thus, the two continental centers that exerted most pressure on English affairs in the first years of Edward's rule were Zurich and Strasbourg. The Strasbourg position was a moderate one that was difficult to retain and difficult sometimes even to proceed. Consequently, what continental reformers who came to England discovered upon arrival was a group of rather able Zwinglians, some of whom were Englishmen with all the advantageous connections of navies. Under the influence of this majority opinion, the foreigner who wished to receive preferment in England had little choice but to move toward what seemed to be the dominant position. Cranmer himself, in the years from 1547 to 1549, gives the impression that he was open to the suggestion of emigrants from any of the continental centers. Wittenberg lost his opportunity for influence in England by sending over unseasoned, uninterested men. Luther, who had trained his men in middle-of-the-road moderation, sent serious, conscientious reformers, but their moderation worked against them in the strongly Zwinglian atmosphere of the Hooperites. Consequently, the foreigners who obtained positions of power in the English Church in the latter part of Edward's reign were those who had come originally from Strasbourg, men like Poulain and Duke Claudius, but who had been willing to adjust to the Zurich position after their arrival in England.
After this exchange, the title, the year 1517, and the life that failed. There had never been before, nor has there been since, so fierce and spectacular a battle in the book as that which reached its climax in the year 1517 with the publication of the second book of letters of obscure men. It had been raging 5 years and was to continue for 3 years more. Then suddenly to sputter out when a greater flame kindled by one Martin Luther blazed forth terribly. The storm center of this controversy was the great German humanist John Royston. Fellow humanists came vigorously to the aid of their colleagues. Royston, writing to Pope Leo X in 1617, complained of, quote, "This 5-year-long war, which, as you know, my enemies have waged against me. End of quote. But he was cheered by the support of, quote, all the learned men of all ages, from whom I daily receive letters declaring that I have never been the occasion of scandal to any man in my writings, rather that in the various languages I have striven to establish the church and the Holy Spirit, which, through the diversity of all languages, has assembled the peoples in the unity of faith. These men observed clearly that I, first of all, brought Greek to Germany, and that I, before anyone else in the universe of church, presented and taught the art and studies of the Hebrew language. I trust that you, most blessed Pope Leo, will justly restore peace and tranquility of soul to me, because of my many and difficult labors for the Orthodox faith. End of quote. Writing a statement of his religious goals sounds forced, but he is surely trying to show that he and his fellow humanists are defending a program to which they are deeply committed. At the commencement of the 16th century, there had come into being a European fellowship of intellectuals who presently present the appearance of being linked together in a joint enterprise. They were all dedicated certainly to the revival and cultivation of the languages and literature of ancient Greece and Rome, and moreover to the purifying of the Latin tongue which had remained alive for so many centuries at the cost of becoming barbarized. The leading spirits of this fellowship were natives of England, France, and the German land. We have long called them humanists, and specifically Northern humanists. There was no easy flow of humanism into the North. The entrenched scholastic curriculum of the Northern universities proved a formidable obstacle. Their faculties fought the very admission of the new learning. English, French, and German scholars supported each other in an attack on scholastic pastimes. They were given international lay support by kings, high clergy, nobles, and men of wealth. The humanists had in Erasmus of Rotterdam a real coordinator of the attack. They traveled around extensively, kept up a constant correspondence with his chief lieutenant. The defenders of the old curriculum had practically no international cohesion and almost no great lay adherence. The scholastics defended each citadel separately. In many places they were forced to admit the invaders and were then vanquished in the strife within the gates. At length, the Cologne faculty thought they saw a way to turn the tables. They had found an issue over which they were prepared to go all out. A fierce anti-intellectual named Pfefferkorn had been converted from Judaism in 1560. He became an ardent Christian proselytizer and soon focused his energies in an attack on all Jewish books except the Old Testament. The Dominicans at the University of Cologne decided to support him. The Holy Office swung into action, and in 1509 the Emperor Maximilian was persuaded to order the Jews to surrender their books. However, the Primate of Germany, the Archbishop of Mainz, demanded the more expert judgment be sought. The upshot was that Pfefferkorn invited an opinion from the Heidelberg Professor Reusmann, the very man who'd been introducing Hebrew studies into Germany. Reusmann defended the Hebrew books, and the battle was on. Pfefferkorn attacked him in the pamphlet. Reusmann replied in the Algemeine Spiegel. At this point, the Cologne theologians found heretical statements in the humanist response. It must certainly have appeared to the humanist fellowship that the scholastics had decided to go all out against their rivals and critics. Humanism would be painted with heresy in the realm of Hebrew studies, but the attack would scarcely stop there. Only the papal sanction of Erasmus' 1516 edition of the New Testament had muffled the severe rumblings from men who had been stung by the praise of fire. If Reusmann fell, the whole humanist movement might be throttled. Moreover, if the scholastics were content to accept so raw tapping Pfefferkorn, there was a clear case of black ignorance arrayed against enlightenment. This looked so much like a great battle for freedom of thought and expression. The truth, all the right people, even all the powerful people, all on one side. This explains the impact of the letters of obscure men, which Voltaire fashioned almost blew away the opposition in the gale of laughter. So manifestly stupid did Pfefferkorn and his cohort seem. It might have produced great victories to freedom, and much of the intellectual climate of the 18th century might have appeared in the 60s. The Holy Office might have fallen. Liberal papacy might have reformed the church. And then all of a sudden, everything was flooded up in the Lutheran pulpit. The battle, this battle of the book, does not even have a name to go down in history. It is certainly that Erasmus specifically blamed Luther for wrecking him and his children. Early in 1521, he wrote to Nicholas Barrow, quote, "Luther has discredited me and my cause," end quote. Later in the same year, Erasmus wrote to Archbishop Warren, quote, "Luther has been sentenced to the world by the genius of discord. Every corner of it has been disturbed by him." Luther's movement was not connected with learning, but it is about learning and to know the truth, end the quote. To return to the year 1517, despite the troubles of writing, who had lost his post at Heidelberg and was imprisoned by the Inquisition, Erasmus was still supremely confident in the future. In a letter to Capitol, he wrote, quote, "At the present I could almost wish to be young again, for no other reason but this, that I anticipate the near approach of the golden age, so clearly do we see the minds of princes devoting all their energies to the pursuit of peace. The chief movers in this matter are Pope Leo and Francis, King of France," end of quote. As regards Leo's case, it is obvious why Erasmus and other humanists could have expected great things from the son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, the great-grandson of Cosimo, for he possessed a premeditated appreciation of letters and the arts. And until the Lutheran controversy arose, Leo satisfied the fondest humanist hope. In 1517, Erasmus hailed Leo as, quote, "by his own endowment supreme among the supreme," end of quote, and continued to write to him as follows, quote, "I congratulate this our age, which did serve to be an age of gold, if ever such there was, when I see, under your happy auspices and by your holy counsels, first that true Christian piety, which has in many ways fallen into decay, secondly, learning of the best sort, hitherto partly neglected and partly corrupted, and thirdly, the public and lasting concord of Christendom, and its all imperative of piety and erudition, that these three of the chief blessings of humanity are about to be restored to her. These will be the undying trophies of the tenth Leo, which, consecrated to eternal memory by the writings of learned men, will forever render your pontificate and your family illustrious," end of quote. Such was the false Erasmian prophecy of the rites that failed, addressed to the luminous Medici clans, of whom so much was expected. What if that prophecy had come true? Suppose the humanists had triumphed in the Sepulchral Corn Affair, were we too bold to speculate, a few pages back, that this might have ushered in the intellectual climate of the 18th century? Were Erasmus and his fellow humanists 18th century heroes? The architects of the 18th century lived in the 17th. And as is, Descartes was one of the greatest. It might be instructive to ask whether his mind worked in the same way as the dead of Erasmus. Did they basically think alike? Listen to this bold generalization by Alexis de Tocqueville. Quote, "Who does not perceive that Luther, Descartes, and Voltaire employed the same method, and that they differed only in the greater or less use which they professed should be made of it," end of quote. This gives us more than we bargained for. We shall have to beg leave to substitute our gentle humanist Erasmus in the place of the fierce philosopher Martin Luther.
What is it going to work when he said, "Erasmus lived as it is a hope"? And his facility of his knowledge age, in fact, even though his very consistency in biological, he disowned the product.
With or without this human being, we think the Tocqueville supports this thesis well and cogently. In the 16th century, reformers subjected some of the dogmas of the ancient faith to the scrutiny of private judgment, but they still withheld it from the discussion of all the rest. In the 17th century, Bacon and the natural sciences, in philosophy properly, so-called, abolish the state formally, destroy the empire tradition, and oversee the authority of the school. The philosophies of the 18th century, generalizing at length on the same principle, undertook to submit to the private judgment of each man all the objects of his belief. End the quote. This appears to fit very logically with the sense of the first of four precepts which Descartes set up to test the structure of his famous method. The first precept, to accept nothing as true which I did not clearly recognize to be so. The Tocqueville, who considers the entire Cartesian method to be contained in this first precept, perceives that the men of the 16th and those of the 17th century, differing degrees, restricted, as though deliberately, the field of application of this precept, whereas the men of the 18th century made it universally applicable. He is right to ask why. Why particularly did Descartes choose, quote, to apply his method only to certain matters, although he had made it fit to be applied to all, end of quote. The book of the answer is quite simply that its universal applicability could be advanced, quote, only in ages when men's social conditions had at length become nearly equal and men nearly alike, end of quote. This does not, however, explain why the men of the 17th century applied the principle so much more widely than those of the 16th. There is all fair difficulty raised in truth to the discovery of the first Cartesian precept to Erasmus or Prestige Solution. The Tocqueville is quite correct in recognizing the first Cartesian precept as a form of private judgment. But private judgment and the first precept are not the same thing. Private judgment turned into the first precept not when the field of application is widened, for that came later, but rather when the field of observation and even inquiry is arbitrarily restricted. This is what Erasmus could not do. It was what Descartes and Galileo and Newton could, or at any rate, did do. In fact, when the 18th century Cedarsulf widened their field of application to the point of universal applicability, it would seem that their achievement paradoxically depended upon the severe 17th century restriction of the field of observation and inquiry. Descartes tells us that disillusioned with the teachings of the schools, he sought knowledge in, quote, the great books of the world, end quote. The results were placed as confusing as the opinions of philosophers. Accordingly, like his contemporary Galileo, he revised his mode of observation. The, quote, essential qualities of things, position, mass, and motion, were now to be accounted truly real, and such, quote, secondary qualities as color, smell, sound, and so forth could be disregarded. Thus was constructed what Whitehead calls, quote, an ideally isolated system, a scheme of scientific thought framed by mathematicians for the use of mathematicians, end quote. This is the Descartes analyzing the stone, quote, we may reject hardness because if the stone were liquefied or reduced to powder, it would no longer possess hardness and yet would not cease to be a body. Let us in next place reject color and finally reject cold, heat, and all other qualities of the time, end of quote. By a similar restriction of the field of inquiry and observation, a whole society could be analyzed without revealing any hint of what Edmund Burke called its, quote, prescriptive constitution, end of quote. That is a living organism developing and growing over the centuries. One discerned instead, quote, the imprescriptible rights of man, end of quote, and their frustration. Rousseau put it bluntly, quote, man was born free and he is everywhere in sin. Or one may apply Cartesian analysis to God and derive results which would have been of particular interest to Erasmus. One indeed still discovers the Creator, but he is the Creator of a world of truth, the author of natural law, the supreme architect of the universe. It was now up to the theologians to show how the person of God, Scripture, together with the whole body of miracles and dogmas, could be reconciled with the new revelation of science. According to Albert Schweitzer, the theologians capitulated utterly and accepted the scientific category. He calls this the theology of yes, but, meaning, yes, your explanations are marvelous and true, but we have a little bit to add, too. But the scientist ignores them. No more than Descartes inspecting his stone did they propose to discuss irrelevancy. Both this scientific conception of the universe framed in terms of high abstraction and take fighters is quite unbelievable. Yet it has held itself as the guiding principle of scientific studies ever since. It is still raining. No alternative system of organizing and pursuit of scientific truth has been suggested. The 18th century philosophers found this scheme of abstraction ideal for expressing the dominant interests of an epoch. They were men of genius, clear-headed and acute, and applied the 17th century group of scientific abstractions to the analysis of the unbounded universe. Their triumph was overwhelming. Whatever did not fit into their scheme was ignored, derided, disbelieved. End of the quotation. Thus it was the severe restriction of the field of observation and inquiry which made possible the universal application of the Cartesian first precept. This explanation supplements and improves the Book of Enoch. It is evident that the 16th century humanists were unable to narrow the field of their inquiries in any such way. They were taken by surprise to begin with. But even had it been otherwise, the very nature of Renaissance humanism presented an almost insuperable obstacle. Its initial motivations were aesthetic and anti-intellectual, and the critical examination stripped through the first field of rational inquiry to offer itself. Erasmus and his fellow northern humanists did not stand at the culmination of a considerable development, but were in fact pioneers in the intellectualizing, or the attempted intellectualizing, of humanism. Having committed themselves to discussing religious matters, they were trapped. Erasmus could not refuse to discuss theological doctrines with Luther. As soon as he did, he was lost. Thus the light that seemed to burn so brightly in 1517 was snuffed out speedily, quenched by a larger fire.
Thank you. Would you agree that in spite of the pepper corn and many and so forth, Mr. Dooley, you said the Russians won the battle but lost the war? Would you agree with that? Because the execution and the suppression of pepper corn was a victory for the humans over the collapses, but only after 10 years. Well, I expect to be what you said.
I think so, except that the Russians came very much afraid. They broke out things and didn't like it. As you said, Mr. Dooley, if you have others, then you know. The thing is,
you moved forward from an English situation to the continent involving the junior in the name of Erasmus, or Mr. Thorne, is that how I shall pronounce you?
Yes.
Thorne will give us something out of Erasmus's life. Apparently, he had some lost weekends to him.
You have to define the university as well. In early summer of the year 1509, Erasmus in Italy received the enthusiastic letter of his English friend and patron, Lord Mountjoy, announcing the accession of young Henry VIII to his father's throne and the beginning of an age of gold. He began hurriedly to bring his Italian affairs to a close and prepared to depart for England and his bountiful promise. On June 30th, 1509, Erasmus, on the point of leaving Italy, received a short, gossipy, inconsequential letter from Josephus Borsodi, a Hungarian diplomat and politician whom he had met in Rome. There is no record of his replying to it, and we must assume that he left for the north probably within a few days. During the next 22 months, Erasmus dropped some contemporary records, until on April 10, 1511, he wrote his friend Andrea Ammonio from Dover as he prepared to take ship for Paris. Neither the letter from Borsodi in 1509, nor that of Erasmus to Ammonio in 1511, contains the slightest hint of threat or crisis. Neither explains what Erasmus was about to do or had done, where he was to stay or had stayed, and there is nothing between them. Were there ever letters to fill this gap of time? If they were written, were they lost or suppressed? And if the latter, by whom? As T.S. Allen states the problem, quote, Erasmus completely disappeared from view. He published nothing. No letter that he wrote survived. We have no clue to his movement. If he had been anyone else, we might almost conjecture that he was in prison, unquote. While this statement is true enough as regards direct primary evidence, correspondence, work, contemporary references, it is not quite true that he disappeared completely without any clue. There is a considerable body of indirect reference and inferential material which may be used to fill this gap, if not with unimpeachable fact, at least with respectable conjecture. Our first piece of evidence is one of the most famous of Erasmus's letters. The preface is phrased as follows. It was not written until the summer of 1611 to accompany the first printing of the work, but it tells the story of its inception. Quote, while returning recently from Italy to England, unquote. Erasmus broke his long, hard trip at several points along the way. An undated letter from his friend Paolo Bombacci to Albert says that Erasmus visited him, presumably in Bologna, quote, 3 days ago on his journey from Rome, unquote, that he was hurrying to England on the promise of his machinist, Lord Mountjoy. He may have stopped briefly at Constance at Strasbourg. He visited Antwerp and Louvain. And then, after his usual miserable channel crossing, he reached London about the middle of July and the long-awaited company of his English friend, college theologian, who was Dean of St. Paul's, Grocyn, Latimer, Lineker, and especially Thomas More. The story is then picked up from another famous letter, again much later in date, in the first few weeks of his return to England, but referring to those weeks. It is a letter defending the praise of folly, written in March 1516 to the Louvain theologian Martin Van Dorp, in which Erasmus undertook the impossible task of explaining irony to his completely humorless correspondent. In the course of his careful and patient explanation, he said, "When I returned from Italy and was staying at the home of my friend Moore, my kidney ailment kept me inside for a few days. My books had not yet been delivered, and even if they had been, sickness prevented me from doing any serious work. I began to amuse myself and pass the time with the praise of folly, with no intention of publishing it, but only to lighten the time of illness with this little diversion. When it was underway, I showed some of it to several friends. They all laughed and were so pleased that they insisted I go on with it." I agreed and spent about a week at the job. Thus, the train of thought, which had begun with an ingenious Greek pun, issued in Erasmus' most famous and controversial work. He probably spent the next few weeks with Moore, recuperating from his journey, polishing the manuscript of the Moria, enjoying once more the company of the friends who flocked to Moore's house, and planning his assault on those mountains of gold to which Mountjoy had referred so tensely. At this point, it becomes impossible to construct an accurate chronology of Erasmus' movements or activities. Mountjoy had broadly hinted that the king himself would welcome Erasmus, and he had every reason to expect that the young Henry would be generous. Yet there is no evidence of royal favor to him during this period, nor any mention of it in all the later voluminous Erasmian records. Even Mountjoy was unable to be as generous or attentive as Erasmus might have hoped. He was increasingly occupied with royal business and probably gone from England during much of the time with which he was here concerned. Erasmus may have spent some time at Mountjoy's home, but we know that somewhat later, while he was at Cambridge and Mountjoy in France once more, his home was closed by some busybody servant or agent whom Erasmus bitterly labeled that Cerberus. Erasmus probably received little help, little more help from Archbishop Warren, for the years of their closest association still lay ahead. John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, the only other high-ranking English churchman whom Erasmus knew well at this time, had few resources at his disposal. He was closely associated with Cambridge and controlled the appointments to the Lady Margaret professorship. In 1506, he had wanted Erasmus to accept the position at Cambridge. But then, as at this time, Erasmus had no desire to bury himself in a provincial university. He accepted the position finally in the summer or fall of 1611, presumably when he had exhausted every other hope of passing. In all, we must assume that during this period, Erasmus was unable, for one reason or another, to command the substantial support of the great and wealthy. He fell back upon the hospitality of his scholar friends, most of whom were little better off than he. He must have stayed often with Grocer, for in the autumn of 1611, when contemplating a visit to London from Cambridge, he wrote with a pang of conscience to the latter's generosity. There are frequent and familiar references in the Cambridge letters of 1611 to Grocer and to both Linacre and Collett. Linacre had already twitted Erasmus for his constant begging. Collett, furthermore, though he had some family wealth, had poured everything he could find into his school at St. Paul's, and was somewhat shocked with Erasmus for even mentioning money to him. Under the circumstances, Erasmus' most congenial friend during these years was undoubtedly Andrea Ammonia. He had much in common with this Italian adventurer. They were both expatriates, both were fortune hunters, and they shared the common bond of Italianate Latin humanism which neither found in the same degree among the circle of their English friends. They were undoubtedly much together in the months following Erasmus' return. Ammonio was also a periodic guest at the Moore household and a client of Lord Mountjoy. It is certain that he shared lodgings with Erasmus during part of this time. In Ammonio's hasty reply to Erasmus' letter from Dover in April of 1611, he wrote, quote, "You are marvelously mixed. As people know that we lodge together, I am deafened with the cry, 'What of Erasmus? When will he return? He is simply the son of our age,' and many other things which I don't care to write. to indicate that they had lived together until very recently. They both knew the same people who would hardly be inquiring of Ammonia about Erasmus unless they expected him to know about his friends. It is with the exchange of letters between Erasmus and Ammonia that the epistolary record picks up once more in the spring of 1511. Erasmus traveled with Mountjoy, bound for France. They stopped on their way to visit Wareham at Canterbury and then pressed on to Dover, where Erasmus wrote to Ammonio on April 10, 1511. He was bound for Paris to attend to the printing of the Praise of Solomon, the book he had written more than a year and a half before in the house of Thomas More. His work, like his movement, during the intervening period, other subjects of controversy. It is almost certain that once back in England, and once more in contact, especially with Solomon, Erasmus turned again to the serious matters of religion and reform. The maturity, both of scholarship and purpose, which he brought back from Italy, must surely have responded to his powerful influence in the first months of his return to England. The letters of the fall of 1511 from Cambridge are filled with reports of his theological studies, translations, sacred writings, and commentaries. In the following months, certainly the groundwork was laid and much of the work done, not only for the preparation of the Greek New Testament, but the monumental edition of St. Jerome. During this same period of time, Collett was deeply involved in his new boys' school, St. Paul. We know that Erasmus wrote several works for this school. The first of them was almost certainly done during either 1509 or 1510. This was a small collection of devotional pieces called the Cuncio de Quero Jesus. Like the Praise of Folly, this work was printed later, probably in September 1511, but we have no later account of its composition. Since it was an occasional piece celebrating Collett's school, it may not be dated earlier than 1510, the year the school was completed. Since it was published, probably September 1st, 1511, the chances are very good that it was written during these lost years. Included rather incongruously among the pious verses of the Cuncio volume is a brief epitaph, quote, an epitaph for a drunken rascal, unquote. The rascal in question was probably an obscure humanist named Hermitus, whom Erasmus had known in Italy. The reference takes us back to that last letter Erasmus received in the summer of 1509 before he left Italy for England. In a postscript, its writer, Dr. Dysborcides, says he was waiting for Erasmus' epitaph for, quote, that no good wine bibber, unquote. The epitaph was probably not written at the time because Erasmus was in the midst of his hurried preparation. It seems equally unlikely that it was written specifically for the occasion's publication in the fall of 1511. Its subject and tone are completely out of joint with the rest of the works with which it appears. It was probably written during the intervening time, in some spare moment, when Erasmus turned his thoughts back to Italy. He must have done this often. In later years, he said he wished he had stayed in Italy, and certainly he must have entertained such thoughts as the weeks of his return to England stretched into months and then years, without bringing him the preferment for which he had been led to hope. On the other hand, his memories of Italy were filled with bitterness and disillusionment. He had seen the decay of Italian Renaissance civilization, the shocking corruption of the Italian clergy, and he had seen what he came to regard as the root abuse of them all, the brutal secular policy of the warlike Pope Julius II. The Praise of Folly is the primary document of Erasmus' reaction. He makes folly contrast the behavior of Pope with the imitation of Christ. He makes her speak of the abuses of power and might, and finally, and most bitterly, of the wars in which the Pope involved himself. Quote, here you can see tired old men, packed with useful energy and disregard all labor and expense, simply in order to overturn laws, religion, peace, and human institutions, unquote. For all their transparent cloak of generality, these condemnations were clearly meant for Julius II. Delusions are unmistakable. The sentiments expressed in the Praise of Folly in the summer of 1509 did not change. If anything, they became more bitter, as Erasmus turned with increasing seriousness of purpose to his work of religion reform. He and his English friends must often have talked of the disgrace that Julius brought to the church. In the fall of 1511, Erasmus at Cambridge wrote frequently and anxiously to Ammonio for any news that he might have of Italy and the, quote, invincible Julius, end quote. In one letter, he gleefully reported the rumor that Julius was dead. The obvious conclusion of this hostility was the famous Julius Exclusion. But there was at least one earlier Julian work, a satiric epigram. The burden of this short piece is a comparison of Julius II with Julius I, the latter represented as a seeming and rather unheroic Caesar. In the course of the work, the Pope is accused not only of warmongering, but of being diseased, insane, and addicted to unnatural vice. Even in an age accustomed to personal vilification, this was a bitter attack upon a reigning pontiff. The epigram was not published until the present century from an Erasmian autograph. But like the Julius Exclusion, it was probably circulated among Erasmus' friends. The manuscript copy in which it survives bears Thomas More's name on the reverse side, but no date. There is nothing in the document itself, and no hint in other contemporary records to pin it to a definite time and place. It has been written at any time since 1506 in Italy, France, the Low Countries, or England. While Erasmus certainly held the same anti-Julian sentiments in Italy, he would probably have been discreet enough not to express them in this form. He was far too vulnerable to the terrible Julian temper, and at this very time he was seeking from Julius a dispensation from the disability that was the legitimate birth. But once in England, there was another matter. The opening years of Henry VIII's reign brought a certain freedom of expression, especially for the men of culture who were close to the throne. Many of these were friends of Erasmus. Thus, the Julian epigram was probably written in England. The editor of the Erasmian Opuscula suggests that it might have been sent to More from Cambridge. It seems more likely that it was written at some time prior to the fall of 1511, read, listened to, and approved by More, the others of Erasmus' London friends, and left with More upon Erasmus' departure for Cambridge. In the midst of all his other activities, Erasmus was probably preparing a revision of the Adagius, which had been last printed by Aldus in Venice. How much he had done on it, we cannot say, but in a letter to Ammonio from Paris, April 27, 1511, he mentioned some revision notes which he had previously shown to Ammonio. With all our speculation about where Erasmus might have been and what he might have been doing, between the summer of 1509 and the spring of 1511, the kernel of the puzzle still remains, the missing letter. Indeed, this is principally what creates the puzzle at all. In the first place, there probably never were many letters from this period. There are only 14 to and from him during the years in Italy, and scarcely more than 200 in all before the year 1509. Incidentally, two additional letters have just been reported, neither of which has any bearing on this paper, and only one of them is of much consequence at all. Furthermore, circumstances conspired to reduce his contact on the continent in Italy, France, and the Low Countries. For these reasons, then, at best, his correspondence for the years 1509 to 1511 would have been scandalous. But for there to have been no letters at all is scarcely credible. It is possible, of course, that the letters were simply lost. It is more likely, however, that they were not lost at all, but suppressed, and by Erasmus himself. Considerable weight is added to this supposition by the absence of anything but indirect and passing references to this period in his later writings. He might have suppressed them if he did some of the letters of his youth, because they contain nothing of consequence. But if our reconstruction of these years is accurate at all, we must reject this proposition. This leaves only the conclusion that he suppressed them because they were in some way embarrassing or incriminating to him. I believe it was his apprehension about the effects of his satiric writing upon his clerical position, and particularly upon his relations with the papacy. Like all men of letters in his day, Erasmus was torn constantly between integrity and self-interest. He had a fierce hatred for the policies and methods of Julius II, but at the same time he was under obligation to him for the dispensation Julius had granted him in 1505 and 1506, and he might very well have to call upon the Pope for other favors. Erasmus was no defiant Luther, and he had no desire to cut himself off either from Julius or from Julian Rome. It is my contention that what letters there were from these lost years were so shot through with opinions and comments about Julius that Erasmus could not afford to let them survive. If he would not save his hand from satire, the only thing left was to destroy the evidence. Thank you.
Duels, if that could be in duels, that would be a good one.